K-26, Side 1, House Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee 3, March 22, 1979, 8:30 a.m., Room 350, Public Hearing and Work Session on House Bills 2362, 2364, and 2635, and H.C.R. 2.
Subcommittee 3, the House Judiciary Committee, is in order. We have on the agenda 4 measures related to crime victim compensation. The first one is House Bill 2362. We are in a public hearing and possible work session. Representative Starr, would you?
Thank you.
Go ahead. Back distance. Every one of these rooms, these things are placed in a different place in order to work right.
You're hearing it very well, sir.
Okay, fine. I'm George Starr, State Representative in District 17 in Multnomah County, and I had really had an interest in what happens to victims of crimes. There's a lot of the effort goes into using the victim as statistics and some kind of a basis for measuring out the punishment to the criminal, and then the efforts go on from there a lot toward rehabilitating that person, which I think is great, but I think all too often the plight of the victim is sort of ignored, and that is really what the 3 bills that I have before you today are all speak to, the plight of the victim. And House Bill 2362 was taken roughly from a statute that was enacted in New York State, and it was
we can
call it the Son of Sam Bill, I guess, if you like. Yeah. Okay. In 1977, Governor Hugh Carey of New York signed into law a bill that all profits accumulated through a criminal's notoriety be placed in a special fund to aid victims or their families. House Bill 2362, as I said, is patterned after that. It provides that when a person is charged with or convicted of the commission of certain violent crimes in this state and then contracts with anybody to do a story regarding that crime for a book, movie, record, radio, or TV presentation or any other media, the money that is earned shall be placed in escrow in the State Accident Insurance Fund. The money so deposited would be held for 5 years, subject to claims by victims of the crime who must first bring a court action and receive a judgment. After 5 years have elapsed since the escrow account was set up, and there are no claims by the victims against that account, or upon dismissal of the charges or acquittal of the individual whose earnings are in that escrow account, the money can then be drawn out and the account closed. I feel it's abhorrent to one's sense of justice and decency that an individual has committed a violent crime can expect to receive large sums of money for a story while people may lie dead or be injured as a result of the person's conduct. The bill would make it clear that in all criminal situations that the victim must be entitled to be made whole and his or her rights are superior to those of the criminal. If this bill is enacted, it is something I hope would never be used. One of those situations. Better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it, you might say. And that is just a brief presentation of what that's about. It's a new concept to Oregon, but I understand it's been tried in New York and been very successful.
George, on that point, has there ever been any test litigation on the validity of the New York approach?
Not that I'm aware of.
I do notice that the statute does differentiate between those who are accused and those who are convicted. No money could be paid over to the victim unless there was a conviction. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. But the accused and the convicted is in there so that the account could be triggered on the accusation. And then if that is an acquittal, then it would just be, if there's anything in it, it would be paid out to the person. I had I guess I got on a kick this session about toward neutering all the statutes, and wherever I find a his or hers or himself or he or something, and then I'm submitting suggested amendments to bills, and I've got a copy of this bill that I've circled those references, and I may have missed them all, but I'm going to leave it with the committee.
For John.
Yeah. Okay.
George, while you're here, if you'd like to go ahead and testify on HCR 2 while you're doing work, I take your testimony.
All right. Thank you very much. I had the House Concurrent Resolution 2 drafted at the request of the Multnomah County District Attorney, who is here to enlarge on my testimony and make the case for it. I have it again speaks to the plight of crime victims, and that the sense of this resolution is that it would declare the week of April 23rd to 27th of this year that public awareness should be encouraged as to the need for crime prevention and reporting, as well as to the rights of victims of crimes and the services available to them. The amendments that I've offered to the committee, they strengthen the language of the resolution. They don't change it any. And I would, because of the timeline, there's this April 23rd week, if the committee and the full committee and the legislature does do anything with it, which I sincerely hope they do, I think time is kind of important in order that it go through the House and the Senate and get to the governor's desk by April 23rd. And so if the committee, subcommittee, this is a subcommittee, and did look favorably on it, and I hope they do, can move it on its way so that it could go through the process and be timely in the third week in April.
Is there any particular significance for the 23rd or the 27th? Is that the anniversary of some crime or of the passage of the crime compensation
ordinance? I'll defer that question to Harold Haas, who will.
Questions? George, thank you very much. We'll be back to you if we need further assistance.
About 2364?
Excuse me?
2364.
Oh,
I had an opener on that, too.
I'm sorry, sir.
Well, it's all right.
Please go ahead.
Okay. This is another bill that I had drafted and introduced at the request of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and it would amend the law that was enacted in the last session that would provide compensation for victims of crimes, certain crimes. The changes provided in this bill would remove the requirement that $250 be deducted first before any payments made to the victim. It also deletes the section in the current statute to make it that would now make it possible that a victim could be to qualify could be a person that's related to the assailant or sharing the same household, and it also enlarges the crimes to cover negligence acts. And that is all that I have to say on the bill. I strongly support it, and Multnomah County District Attorney is here to make a strong case for it, and I also have some neutering amendments to offer to that one. Okay.
Questions? George, what's the fiscal impact comes out to $146,000 above and beyond the governor's budget recommendation?
I haven't seen that, but I know that there would be one, and we'd have to, the committee will have to look at that to put it all into perspective.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Harl, why don't you join us next? In much these bills have been introduced. Many other mature requests.
Thanks. I know you're David.
You've got a busy day, too.
Thank you.
And we'll take them in whatever we've already.
Okay, perhaps we can.
We'll take them whatever order you think.
All right. Perhaps we go to House Concurrent Resolution Number 2. In answer to your question, my name is Harl Hospital, County District Attorney. Dave, in answer to your question on the timing of that April 23rd through the 27th, there are around, I believe now, 10 states in the country that are holding Forgotten Victims Week or Crime Victims Week.
during that particular period of time, we'll be, if I'm correct on the figure, the 10th state to join together in that effort, California being the first state to do so around 4 years ago, and several additional states joining them now. It's also important because we've anticipated the support of the legislature. The Oregon District Attorneys Association has passed a proclamation proclaiming that week as Crime Victim Week. Governor Attia is going to sign a proclamation on behalf of the Executive Department, likewise proclaiming the week Crime Victims Week. We're going to bring approximately 4 to 5 busloads of crime victims to the legislature that week, anticipating perhaps that the trying to schedule the Victims Compensation Bill to weave its way to the Ways and Means Committee by then, so that we would have actual victims of crime who have not been awarded compensation due to the restrictions in the bill, and those who have and what it's meant to them to be able to testify for the legislature. We will be bringing all the district attorneys of the state to Salem that week to meet with the governor and to meet with the judiciary committees and to meet and to invite all of you to attend our conference. And it will give us an opportunity to, hopefully, that some of the DAs who just because of time and travel restrictions can't get down here during the year to talk to their individual legislators, it'll give them an opportunity to be here and to spend a couple of days and to discuss pertinent legislation with each of you. So that's kind of the reason for the timing and why we are interested in seeing it proceed. There are close to 300,000 crime victims in Oregon each year. Over 10,000 of those people are victims of serious violent crimes. And we think that it, you know, it points out that there's a need to sensitize the public as well as all of us in public office that there's been a forgotten member of our society, and that person has traditionally been the victim of crime. The program developed out of the last session, the Victims Compensation Program, was a giant first step towards recognizing that those people have legitimate rights just as the offender who committed the crime against them has. The additional victims programs that have been springing up in Oregon and throughout the nation in district attorney's offices and sometimes in corrections division's offices, likewise, has demonstrated a concern and an awareness. During that week, there's going to be public service announcements on most of the major radio and TV stations throughout the entire week. We're going to have a lot of fun with it. Each county is going to have activities within the courthouse concerning Crime Victims Week. In our county, we're going to give an award to the individual who's done the most as an individual citizen to help stop crime. It may be one single act that they did that saved a life or what have you, but we're receiving nominations. There will be a person who will be selected by the Oregon District Attorney's Association statewide to receive such an award also. And we're having a poster coloring contest for all the 4th, 5th, and 6th graders in the community concerning Crime Victims Week, where we're going to select 5 winners. And then we have a senior citizen slogan contest that all the senior citizens are going to participate in, where 5 of them will be selected as winners and will be on TV and will be given an award and a luncheon and so forth. So I think you can just see overall it's an attempt to bring to public awareness and to all of us in public life, our awareness, the fact that they are out there, they do exist, they do have problems, and they do wish to for all of us to be aware of it. And that's really the purpose of the week. I'd be glad to take any questions if anybody has any on that.
Questions? On 2364, there's a 6-month statute of limitation in it presently. Do you have any inclination to extend that at all? I noticed there's a, they can extend it for good cause, but to me, 6 months perhaps seemed a little short.
Well,
is there any problems with the shortness of that?
I can't point out any instances that have occurred to our knowledge where it's worked a hardship. And I would think that if there's any reasonable valid cause, that if the district attorney or the law enforcement agency involved would be supportive, which I think they would be, I have confidence that the administrator of the funds would be sympathetic to that. The on that bill, Tom, the directing testimony of that bill, there's several things that it does. It's not really a sweeping piece of legislation. It seems to me it. I remember last session, it's been so tough to get victims' compensation that we were willing to accept, you know, a bare bone if necessary, and the legislature gave us much more than a bare bone. But in the spirit of compromise and to get an experience factor, if you will, behind us as to what it was going to cost, also to find out what, if anything, the federal government was going to do on Rodino's bill and Kennedy's bill to pay the states up to 50% of the cost of the program if they enacted it. We wanted to just take what we could get and wait. I might share that with you. It might be of interest to you. I was back in Washington before the Senate Judiciary Committee twice in the last 3 months, and I've been led to believe by people associated with the administration that because of the desire to balance the budget and forestall legislative action on national constitutional conventions, that that the administration may not support the bill just as a budget matter. But I've also been told by members of the Senate Judiciary Committee that there is strong support from the chairman of the committee, Senator Kennedy, and others to pass the bill. If they pass it, I would doubt, you know, I would be doubtful of a veto, but in any event, that's kind of where it sits right now. What this bill does, basically, is to say that we don't need a $250 minimum deduction. And what we find on that is that it precludes from consideration really an awful lot of people who are in more need than some who will, in fact, receive compensation. It's basically unfair to rape victims because the medical expenses incurred as a result of sexual abuse are usually less than the $250 minimum. So it is really discriminatory towards the woman, not only in the sense of sexual assault, but also in the sense of domestic violence cases, which is in a different section, but is also in the same category, that the expenses of medicals are usually lower, and they therefore don't qualify, and certainly in the area of domestic violence. The need is usually staggering because whether or not she can get to a shelter, stay in a shelter, make a rational decision to prosecute or not, is based upon some sort of financial support because normally he's not going to provide it. This bill would deal with that, would say there doesn't have to be a 250 minimum, and that we would treat those victims of crime as we treat any other victims. It really just plows in equal protection. As I said, the domestic crime victim was excluded. The reason, really, that it was excluded was that it had been excluded in other states. That was been the kind of the history of the development of victims' compensation bills throughout the country. We held a victims' conference in Portland approximately 2.5 years ago, and we had the administrator of the program in the state of Washington down. And he gave a speech to us, and in speaking on this exclusion, what they had in the Washington law also, he stated he sincerely hoped the Washington legislature, and I don't know if they have, would remove that exclusion because he felt that he'd seen case after case after case that it really worked an injustice because the woman happened to be married to or living in the same household with a person who assaulted her. Again, I don't see substantial costs in terms of dollars. In our county, we had around 220 domestic violence cases last year. There are just many of those cases that are not going to be prosecuted, and Jack's going to talk to you about some problems in the area of, do we just pay the medical bills in those cases? Is there a continued problem of collusion as it results to loss of income? I recognize the difficulties of administering in that area, but I just think that also the need perhaps in that area is so substantial that it should be given serious consideration to include loss of earnings. We would guess the average claim would only be around $47. It's just not that much. But it is a lot to that particular individual if they can have it. Another thing that will come up is that many of these cases, the woman does not desire to prosecute. And I think unlike any other crime, many times we fully concur with that decision because the act of prosecution may very well be counterproductive for a multitude of reasons. We may know that given that kind of case, the track record of the judiciary will be straight probation, which means that he may say, forget it, to her as far as support for her and the children are concerned, or he may go back and re-victimize her, feeling that he can do it and get away with it because it's happened once before. And we may want to, I don't think probably this is the session, but we may want to consider this type of case as a special category, because we've applied for a federal grant in the county, which would provide a diversion program for domestic violence cases where the defendant would be mandatorily diagnosed, and if a recommendation for diversion would occur, if we concurred with that decision, he would be diverted to counseling and a planned program for him, as well as counseling for the family and the children and the wife or the person that he was living with, so that there would be total counseling for those people and a program, a planned program put out, which if completed, then we would have diverted and would not have prosecuted. Actually, you'd be getting more cooperation, and the community would be receiving more benefit, I believe, from that kind of program than they would be for just straight prosecution. I guess what I'm saying is down the line, we might want to come back with you and discuss eliminating the need for prosecution of those kind of cases in order for a person to qualify. But it's probably premature now. I just say in those two areas especially that you can't help but sit in our office and just feel that basically the law is discriminatory as it relates to the way it falls through enforcement, that most women, are not prosecuted for assaulting men. The opposite is the case, and as a result, they're precluded from benefits that if the husband or the boyfriend were in a bar and got beat up, that he'd be entitled to. And we'd like to straighten that out so that those people are not singled out as undeserving of the consideration of the state. Jack has some figures, and I have some in a handout that I had, but in fairness to him, I would like to recompute our figures. We may be low. We're substantially lower than he is. One problem in victim compensation programs nationwide is that people don't know they exist. And unfortunately, his office has not received any allocation of funds so that a public information program of a decent nature could be undertaken to advise the public that there are those programs and how they apply for them. He's basically left to the handiwork of the police officers and our offices and other DA's offices to funnel those people to him. And we're going to try to put together, again, a public information program for Multnomah County to assist in the public awareness. But we don't see a large financial impact. I think, Dave, you used a figure, apparently the governor's office is...
Well, we have a fiscal analysis that says it's $146,000 extra above the governor's budget.
I would guess that that would be certainly in the ballpark. The only other area, and this is one that as lawyers, all of you will have some individual judgments on, and that's the the issue of criminally negligent homicide, basically, where your gross negligence test basically is the test, and it's been excluded. Betty Roberts has stated that it was an oversight during the last legislature. I'm not sure that it was an oversight. I think everybody felt that we wanted a bill at any cost to get a track record. But in any event, I can say to you in all sincerity, and I think this is an anomaly, and I can't explain necessarily why, but negligent homicide cases, in my experience in almost 7 years as a district attorney, produce more grief and frustration for the survivors of that deceased than any other kind of case that we touch, and that includes rape, and it includes murder, and what have you. I don't know what there is about it. If it's the fact that the person that has committed the act normally is not thought of as, you know, carrying a gun or being a criminal type, if you will, that creates a frustration level of why did it have to happen or what have you. But they are the most sensitive cases as far as those people dealing with that loss and dealing with that tragedy that we handle in our office. And a recognition by the legislature concerning perhaps at least the area of burial expense and that type of thing, I think would really be appropriate. And I think it would do a lot for those people, too. It would help the next of kin deal with the problems that they have. And that's all I have, Dave, on the two programs.
Questions from members of the committee? Gentlemen, is this bill has substitution for all the ways and means?
Yes.
They do.
Two of them do.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, thank you,
Dan. We'll now move back to 2364. Jenny McCoy. If you were planning to testify with other people, they're welcome to join you. They want to do a separate, okay? Go ahead. If you have separate testimony, we'll take it separately. I thought maybe something would come together.
Well, I just found out about this morning. But, my name is Jenny McCoy. I work with the Governor's Commission for Women, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2364 with some questions that I have about certain areas of it. First off, the area I'm particularly concerned with and supportive of is the enlargement of the definition of victim to include persons who are related to one another or who are residing in the same household. This categorical exclusion of these people when the bill was initially enacted was done due to the committee's hesitation concerning issues such as collusion, and no one had come up to testify one way or the other about the effects of collusion. I feel that the exclusion of these victims is patently unfair and unnecessary. It includes minor children, and an example of this recently happened in Florida. I was reading about it in the newspaper yesterday, where a husband killed his wife and then killed himself, and their infant daughter was not eligible for any Social Security benefits or any other benefits, which would be pursuant to their victim compensation law, and was also not eligible as a victim, and they were unable to figure out an exception to their law other than to declare that the couple's marriage was invalid. And so right now that child, who's about 3 months old, is virtually without any victim compensation at all for that, I guess a double crime, whatever. Changing the bill along those lines would alleviate that sort of a situation, which, given is a fairly exaggerated one. Changing this definition will be of particular use to victims of domestic violence, which is predominantly women, and it seems that it, again, is unfair to exclude people from recovering just on the basis of their marital status or who they're living with. It also would exclude people who are roommates, and I get real uncomfortable with that because I tend to live with roommates, and I'm not married to them. And And I would like, if they commit a crime against me, to have some way of being compensated for that if there isn't any other avenue. There's some areas of this bill that I'm not comfortable with. One is the issue of the victim is required to cooperate fully with the law enforcement agency. I appreciate Carl Haas's sympathy towards victims and his cooperation, but I don't know that that will be extant through the entire state. And I'd be concerned about what fully is defined as.
Mr. McCoy, you're not comfortable with the saving clause in there, which says, or the fund on page 3, line 5, about a third into the sentence, it says, or the fund has found that the applicant's failure to cooperate was for good cause.
Okay, I'm not certain that good cause, again, the definitions of good cause I'm uncomfortable with, because, for example, in the employment division, to get unemployment benefits for quitting with good cause, there's a state, the case area defines that a woman who quits her job with the state for good cause, if she quits because her spouse is abusing her, that is not considered good cause. Now, that's a completely separate issue, but I'm uncomfortable with that word good cause. It seems to me that it's been used so often to the detriment of victims who are female. So I'm not sure that saving clause will save it. Now, maybe it will, but
I see the situation you're talking about, and where, you know, because of the trauma of the rape case, especially the victim may not wish to pursue it quite as fully as a third party, objective third party who has not suffered, may assume that they should pursue it.
Right.
And be denied compensation. But to me, that's exactly what the saving clause is there for. But you're afraid that that will not be the interpretation.
I have some concerns about that. My concern is primarily that administratively, law enforcement victim compensation are not sympathetic to the particular problems that women have, given the trauma and their socialization. And that when a third party, and these are usually administered by from a male point of view, a reasonable person, a reasonable victim, is not, in their definition, a traumatized woman. And her reactions would not be considered good cause or full cooperation. Do you understand what my concern is? And so that their understanding of her situation will be one of, well, she's a flake. And they won't have gone into in detail exactly why she reacted that way and whether or not that was a reasonable reaction given her circumstances.
Do you have any suggested language?
No, I don't. Other than, I'm not sure.
I see your point, but I'm trying to think of how to get around it short of complete removal of the language,
mm-hmm.
which there's something to the thrust of the language, but I think your point is well taken too, so if you can...
Well, my personal feeling, and I'm not sure this is the position of the Commission, is that the bill, as it was originally drafted, was adequate if they were to enlarge the definition and to leave it as it was without the requirement of the law enforcement cooperation. But I understand the need for that, and I have no problems with doing it in this way.
Well, I think it was part of the basic concept of the public bill or a bill. There were maybe four or five different approaches to the victim's compensation idea that developed over a 10 or 12 year period,
mm-hmm.
which was being introduced in the legislature. This is, to my knowledge, part of almost every single victim's comp bill in the whole country, of which there are quite a few now.
Can you give us perhaps a concrete instance of where this has been a problem?
I can't. I'm just really concerned about a victim who, let's say, is terrorized by her spouse, her ex-spouse, and is so immobilized by that fear that she can't comply with, let's say, going to the police or those situations.
couldn't, I don't want to be the devil's advocate to a great extent, but couldn't you make the argument there that that's exactly the victim that should go to the police, that we want to change people's habits in that case, and that anything that may move them closer to going towards the police in that situation would be a commendable law. I know the type of case you're talking about, and sometimes they don't go to the police, and they absolutely should.
I don't see how denying a person that's going to not go to the police is not going to go for victim compensation benefits either, if they're that terrorized. I guess that's the situation I'm looking at, and it's more of a concern rather than an objection. The other questions I have are also concerning that 6-month statute of limitation. And I'm not sure if the 72-hour reporting limitation was in there previously or not.
Unless it's in bold-faced type, it was
it
in
was.
Existing law.
Okay.
Representative Rutherford?
Does that 6-month statute of limitation or the 72-hour timeline cause any problem in the past?
Not that I know of, but then this category of victims has been excluded. And I'm particularly concerned about victims of domestic violence. So since they've been excluded, their particular problems haven't come up. The problems with that sort of occurring. So.
Would you advocate a different timeline for them or changing the entire timeline?
I would say neither. I guess I would also raise that as a concern. More that if victims are then harmed by it, then it should definitely be taken a good look at. That's pretty much all I have.
Okay, further questions? Jenny, thanks. Okay, again on 2364, Karen Ennis.
My name is Karen Ennis. I live at 853 Northwest Adams Street in Sheridan, Oregon. I'm a lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition, which supports HB 2364. It seems only fair to remove the $250 deductible limitation which is in the present law. The purpose of a victim compensation law is to compensate victims, and the victims of crime are most often the poor. An elderly lady who is knocked to the ground when her purse is snatched probably does not incur large medical expenses, but she probably does go to the emergency room of a hospital to be x-rayed and examined by a doctor, and she may have some expenses for drugs. Medicare may cover some but not all of her expenses. If she is living on Social Security, a bill of even $50 can cause her great hardship. She deserves to be compensated. Probably the most controversial aspect of this bill allows persons who live in the same household as the assailant to be compensated. The people of Oregon and the legislators of Oregon are now engaged in an earnest confrontation with the problem of domestic violence. This bill is an extension of that commitment. By extending coverage to a victim who resides in the same household as an assailant, this bill acknowledges that a woman who is beaten by her husband is just as much a victim of crime as is a woman who is beaten by a man who snatches her purse. In effect, this bill says that wife beating is no longer a lesser crime. There are those who may say that this bill would allow an assailant to profit from his wrong by beating his wife, then reconciling with her, and then going off to spend the money received as compensation on a vacation or otherwise enjoying himself. All I can say is that this would be a hard way to earn a vacation. This is the problem of collusion that the district attorney was talking about. In addition, all expenses for which compensation is received would have to be thoroughly documented, just as in any insurance claim. Furthermore, the bill requires that a compensated victim must cooperate fully with law enforcement officials in prosecuting the assailant. Prosecution of a criminal case may take 6 months or more. A woman who reconciles with her husband and decides not to prosecute would not receive compensation under this bill. But a woman who has decided that she is no longer going to tolerate being a victim of domestic violence and prosecute would and should receive compensation under this bill. A section of the current law provides that if the victim's conduct contributed to his or her injuries, the amount of compensation shall be reduced accordingly. The Women's Coalition strongly urges that, as part of the legislative history of this bill, a woman who is a victim of domestic violence be acknowledged by this committee not to have contributed to her own injuries simply because she has incurred previous beatings and has continued to live with her assailant.
Okay, thank you. Questions by members of the committee or by
council? Well, reading your testimony, if I read it correctly, that you disagree with the previous testimony, that you do not object to the fully cooperating provisions of the bill?
I think that there is a difficulty, but I frankly don't know how to solve it other than by saying that at this point, anyway, a victim...
You seem to say that the fully cooperating provisions of the bill in themselves...
Which line is that on, Tom?
It'd be line 4, page 3.
Oh, okay.
You seem to say that that provision prevents collusion.
I think that to a certain extent it does, right? I mean, I think that some people who I've discussed this bill with have said, if a husband beats his wife and then he can get the money from it, there is a potential collusion problem. I don't think we know exactly how it's going to work. And I've been impressed with Mr. Haas's testimony that he thinks that these women are genuine victims and that they need compensation, and I think he's right. But I also want to make sure that the bill works properly and fairly, and that perhaps it can be expanded gradually once we see that the right people are getting money and that other, that collusion is not going on.
I think your point down at the bottom regarding the legislative intent, that we should acknowledge that a woman who is a victim of domestic violence would not have contributed to her own injury simply because she incurred previous beatings and has continued to live with her assailants, probably a well-taken point and should be the legislative intent.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that so that we'll be part of the record. I would also like to clarify something I am not certain about. And that is that it's my understanding that this law applies whether or not the assailant is convicted, that compensation still can be made. But I heard Representative Starr say something which made me think that that might not be the case. And since I don't have 2362 before me, I just have 2364, but...
I don't think conviction is necessary.
Conviction is not necessary. What if you couldn't find the perpetrator of the crime? That would be
right. That I would be very concerned if that were a requirement, and I had assumed it was not. But I thought I would ask. That's all. Thank you.
My name is Mara Sumrall, and I work with the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic Violence. I'd like to testify today in support of House Bill 2364. I would like to give you a brief example of my reasons for supporting the bill. A number of months ago, Dina was severely beaten by her husband and was brought directly to Bradley Englehouse, a shelter for battered women in Portland. He had kicked her repeatedly in the face and abdomen with his cowboy boots on. He was determined that if he couldn't have her, no one would.
She was told she could not receive the medical care she needed for her face unless she could pay for it. She was told she could not become a recipient of welfare and receive medical benefits from them because she had no children. She was left not only with emotional but physical scars that never healed. For a woman leaving a battering situation, medical care for her injuries can seem like yet one more obstacle. It's very difficult for her to endure the traumas of prosecution. If we expect her to see it as a viable alternative, she should receive the compensation that any other crime victim receives. I would like to reiterate the concerns that Karen brought out and refer you to the second page of my testimony, where I referred to two particular clauses. And I guess the question that I have for the committee is if there's anything other than simply recording it in the record that can be done to be certain that that in all parts of the state of Oregon, as this program is administered, battered women aren't thought to have provoked or contributed to their injuries in any way.
No, I don't, although I think your point's well taken, too. I think that if someone were to interpret the language in the negative way, as you thought that they might interpret it, that would be a misinterpretation of the purpose of the language.
Mm-hmm. I would hope so. Thank you.
Thank you. Vern Vogel?
I'm Vern Vogel, Administrative Services Manager of the State Accident Insurance Fund. With me is Mr. Jack Parks, who is the actual manager of the Workers' Compensation Program, which we administer. With the committee's permission, I'd like to review several pieces of legislation related to this program very briefly, just to indicate their duplication or relationship. Senate Bill 255 purports to remove the Crime Victims Program from State Accident Insurance Fund and assign it to some other agency, at this point undefined, has no implications or impact on the program itself. Senate Bill 280 was introduced by our agency to establish limitations on appeal rights. There are two levels of appeal in this program, and we sought to have some finality to that appeal cycle. That intent is incorporated in another bill, I believe it's 2635, House Bill 2635.
What was the number of that one, Senate Bill
1? Senate Bill 280. All it does is set a limit on the appeal time frame. However, I believe that the Senate Judiciary Committee was considering expanding the legislation to provide for payment of attorney fees. Whether they incorporated that in the bill at this point, I'm not sure. The original bill only addressed the issue of time frame. The law precludes them from doing so. It stipulates that no payment can be made for legal services. Whether any have secured legal services or not, I'm not sure. Now, on House bills, you have before you today 2362, the so-called Son of Sam. There is another one, 2623, which is an identical bill with the exception that it provides that funds may be drawn from those that we hold in trust to pay the victim, or not the victim, to pay for the alleged criminal's legal costs out of those held funds. 2364 is the one we're hearing today, addresses the limitation, expands coverage, and that's the essential thing it does. 2635 does the same thing. It removes the 250 limitation. It extends eligibility for reimbursement, and it sets time limits on the appeal of decisions. 2754 was the bill you heard yesterday, which is indirectly related to this program, only that we would administer payments under that particular bill. Our agency has no position on any of these bills. We're here essentially to respond to any questions you may have. I would like the opportunity to comment on our feelings as to the implications of passage of any of these bills, however. And if we are discussing right now Senate or House Bill 2364, we concur that the removal of the $250 limitation is a good idea. The bill, or the legislation that passed at the last session, which was the commencement of this program, was intended to help victims of crime. Many of the victims of smaller crimes are the elderly that have no other sources of funds, and placing a $250 limitation on it freezes them out of any benefits at all. So we think that's probably a good idea. I don't know where the chairman got his dollar figure on cost impact. We submitted a cost impact or fiscal impact statement on this bill, which said that it would be $144,000 a year in claim costs, but additional costs for administration. The aggregate cost of this bill, in our judgment, is $225,000 a year for the first biennium.
Where are you now with respect to what was estimated 2 years ago when we passed the bill?
Quite close. The original appropriation was $600,000, more or less, slightly more than that. $100,000 of it roughly for administrative costs and $500,000 for claim costs. $600 for claim costs plus $100 for administrative costs. We just went to the Ways and Means Committee last week and sought an additional $16,000 to administer the program for the balance of this biennium and received slightly over $10,000, which will be adequate to carry us through. We will obligate nearly all of that $600,000. Now, that does not mean that it will have been paid. The payout period on some claims is extended. We think on the average that it'll take a year to 2 years to pay out the obligations on a given claim, on average. But on the basis of the claims that we have and our judgment as to what their ultimate cost will be, we will spend $585,000 of that $600,000 for crime victims of this biennium's occurrence. As far as the second major issue in this bill, which extends benefits to related people and those sharing households, our only concern there is the administrative problems of determining whether in fact there has been a crime. Our fiscal impact statement on this provides two investigators for the purpose of investigating the aspects of those claims. We have no particular position one way or another on that. Finally, the aspect of extending the intent of this legislation to negligent crimes, we don't feel will have any significant fiscal impact on the bill, and we have no position on whether they're included or not. If I may now, I'd like to respond to a couple questions that came up from other testimony. The good cause that is in there, we feel, is the vehicle to provide a means of getting around the restrictions in the statute. We feel we've administered the program according to legislative intent. We assisted in the development of the legislation at the last session when it was determined that we should administer it. It is our intent and has been and will continue to be to assist claimants. We believe that is the intent of the legislation, that it is not to restrict payment to an extent that you can, but to assist claimants in getting these benefits. And to that extent, we do that. In addition, for the protection of victims, there are two levels of appeal. They can first appeal the decision of our agency to an administrative level in the agency. And if they are not satisfied with that appeal, they may appeal to the Workers' Compensation Board for a final review and determination. So there are two levels of appeal beyond our initial determination. Seems to us that that should be adequate. The six-month limitation and the 72-hour limitation are applicable to the filing of a claim. You need to notify us within 72 hours that a crime has occurred and you are conveying the fact that you're a victim. You have then 6 months after that to actually file a claim. And both of those time frames have a good cause clause on them as well, so that if in our judgment there's been good cause for not meeting those deadlines, they can be extended for an indeterminate period in our discretion. We feel that, again, that is adequate protection for the claimant.
What do you find to be the level of public awareness of your program such that a person would be able to make a claim within that period?
Jack, would you like to respond?
Yes. When the program was set up in October of 77, I spent the 3 months prior to the time for filing of claims contacted all of the large law enforcement agencies from Portland to Klamath Falls. I give them brochures on the program. I give them the cards that they're supposed to hand out. I explain the program to them. The other law enforcement agencies that I couldn't personally contact, I sent a complete package letter explaining the program, the cards and the brochures. We've been contacting the district attorneys. I've worked with Harold Haas's group in Portland, and they have my application forms. There are others in Clackamas, Washington, Lane, Josephine, and Jackson counties that have victim assistance programs. They have all of my information and applications. I have put applications in all of the major hospitals in the state. So the medical community is well aware of the program, and they do like to get paid, so they do help out in this area. So I think the awareness is there. Now, I can't say for sure sometimes whether all of the victims get a card or not, but they have the cards to distribute.
Questions?
By
no
means,
please. Have you given your remarks on all the matters for which you signed up, gentlemen?
No.
All right, why don't you just
two other bills, we want to go into those.
We loosened our agenda this morning, so you can do it in sequence.
I'm looking at your fiscal statement, and you're using the same figures that we supply. They are our figures. What you have read at the $146,000 is a biennial administrative cost only. There is a $304,000 claim cost for a biennial. Yes, on Bill 2364, the fiscal impact statement that was supplied to you, from which you read $146,000, is the administrative cost for the next biennium. Above that figure is the claim cost, which is an additional $305,000 for the biennium. So in aggregate, you're talking $450,000 for the biennium, assuming this entire bill were to pass.
Further questions?
We did supply some statistical data on the operation of the program to date, and I gave that to your clerk. You may want that for future reference.
Mm-hmm.
On House Bill 2362, it's essentially the same bill as House Bill 2623, and I believe 2623 is the one that you are scheduled for hearing today. No, you've got 2362. We have, again, no position on this bill. we would question the need for it unless there is a requirement that you have such statute in order to gain federal funding, which is anticipated to occur. There have been in the federal in federal legislation requirements that states have this kind of legislation to participate in their funding, and that has gone in and out of their consideration. What status it has now?
The Son of Sam.
This is the Son of Sam concept. Yes.
Now we do have, of course, the provision for restitution, which I think was House Bill 2012 that we passed last session, that would allow the court to order restitution from whatever funds would be available to the victim. Is that something that would satisfy such a federal requirement in your judgment?
I don't know. I have not looked at the legal implications of it. But within the Crime Victims Act, there is legislation that requires that we go after the criminal, any assets he may have, for recovery of costs to the program. In addition, there is a subrogation clause in the statute that says if some victim sues and recovers, we have a lien against the costs or that recovery to the extent of our costs. So there is provision for recovery to the program of any monies paid out to the extent of that payout. And all this would do, I think, is cause some administrative problems. We would not know when somebody is selling rights to their crime to somebody, and it's the responsibility of that seller to notify us and to deposit with us any advances and any revenues and so forth. The administration of it would be complicated in our judgment. And we don't feel necessary since we have statutes that provide that we can bring suit for recovery.
Yeah. Well, I'd say, frankly, my position, I can't speak to the other two members who are present or other members who aren't here at all, but I guess I'm reluctant to proceed along the lines of the Son of Sam bill as long as we have a restitution law that's effective and as long as we have otherwise a compensation bill. And I'd be disinclined to do that unless I'm informed by someone or read the federal law that says we have to have that as a component of the program.
Yeah.
I have a copy of the congressional record that was sent to me by Senator Kennedy regarding the putting in of the federal crime legislation, and that is not one of the requirements. There is the requirement here that the state be subjugated, and also the restitution requirements. That's the only one.
Could you provide a copy of that to Ms. Robinson?
Sure.
Sure. Thank you. Further comments, gentlemen, on this or any of the other bills?
I believe 2635 is the other bill scheduled for hearing this morning.
Yes.
Okay.
You're the one signed up for that.
It's the same as the first one, 2362, it has some elements that are the same. The 250 deductible is included for removal. We again concur that that's desirable. It allows non-dependent relatives of victims to receive compensation for burial expenses, and it increases the burial expense limitation. We think that's probably a desirable thing to do, on the grounds that not always is a dependent called upon to make payment for the costs of a medical costs of a victim. To cite an example, I believe it was last year, we had the Newsom girl here in Salem was abducted, raped, and murdered. The family sought restitution from us for burial costs. But because the child was their dependent rather than them being her dependent, no benefits were afforded. They could not collect from this fund. And there are other cases where it would seem that it is desirable to have that kind of a situation taken care of. So we think that that's desirable.
Now, tell me where that's found in the in-house
2635, I don't know the specific. Okay.
Twenty-four
and 25. Okay, expenses and burials, notwithstanding a relative of a victim rather than a dependent, and it adds burial expenses to that.
I'd like to make a comment on that. The other area, which is already in the law, where the eligibility of a relative not dependent can get medical benefits, provided the expenses were paid by him. This is kind of a hard situation for relatives of dependents to get paid. I've had two cases where there were, one was an $18,000 hospital bill and the other one was up in the thousands. No way were the relatives to be able to pay those and then submit bills to me to be reimbursed. So whether or not that was the intent, but that's the way it reads in there. And I think the same thing would happen on your relatives paying the funeral bills in some cases. Sometimes the sister or the aunt or the parents just can't get that kind of money together to make payments. And I found that most, the biggest share of my cases were dealing with not real affluent people, the people who are in need of money. So that is an area which causes problems in payment, because unless they make the payment and submit the bill to me, I can't make the payment to them. The hospital or the funeral home keeps it. In other words, if they can't collect.
And none of this legislation addresses that question. The final area of this bill is incorporates Senate Bill 280, which provides a limitation on the time frame in which you can make appeal on a decision of our agency at the administrative level or onward to the Workers' Compensation Board. We believe that's desirable in that it sets some finality, and the time frame is unimportant as long as there is one. I believe there's a 60-day time limit expressed in Senate Bill 280, and in this bill, I believe it's 180 days, if I recall. But whatever it is, it's immaterial so long as there is some date. We have had only three, since the commencement of the fund, and that includes 290 cases to date, three that requested a hearing at the administrative level, and all but one of those was requested within 60 days. The one that wasn't, there were some reasons that it was not. And Senate Bill 280 provides that we can extend that appeal time frame, again, with good cause. So if that is not in this bill, it could be added in the time frame. See, this one is 180 days on page 3, line 10.
Any questions?
That's all, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I have a list in here of the rundown on the various compensation programs.
I think we move on.
If there's any questions on that, I have a printout paper that I didn't get on there that explains some of the exceptions.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jane Martin.
Good morning. My name is Jane Martin, and I first want to apologize for not having copies for you. I would like to provide copies later on in the day, if that would be acceptable. Thank you.
And incidentally, if there are points that have already been raised by witnesses with which you agree, you can simply indicate your agreement and move on to the matter.
Okay. I'm going to read what I've written. This is the first time I've done this.
Fine.
Bear with me. I would like to address myself to the House Bill 2364. I'm a victim of crimes perpetrated against me in my own home. I was assaulted, threatened, robbed, battered, and left with injuries that caused me to lose 3 months' work. The police was called, but they failed to show. The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office sent a sheriff, and I attempted to have my assailant apprehended. He was not. The reason I was given is that he had not actually seen my assailant strike me. Not being aware of the existing statute, I was not able to make him enforce the law. The sheriff asked me why I didn't use a knife and suggested I get a gun if I didn't already have one. I dismissed his suggestion with utter disgust, as I felt confident that the DA's office would behave in a more intelligent manner. 2 weeks later, I learned that my report had not even been filed with the DA's office. I had to file a new report. 4 district attorneys and 4 months later, my case was submitted to a grand jury on a second-degree assault charge. I had pictures, the hair that he pulled from my head, medical records, witnesses that they refused to hear. But they threw the case on the grounds that I had not been maimed, and it seemed apparent that I was on my feet and walking, even if in a brace. To try to collect $3,000 in losses, I have filed a civil suit. And I had a case until my assailant was deposed. Now my attorney tells me I have no case. She fears the opinion of the jury, and I might not be awarded my losses. I am now left with no recourse, no money, and heavy attorney fees. I submit that the apathy shown by the sheriff, the police, the DA, and the grand jury is a significant breeding point for the graver crimes that are finally heard and then tried under our present system. I submit that the law enforcement officials that fail to respond and act upon such matters of violence in fear of their own safety should indeed seek employment elsewhere. I, as a citizen, want to live within the law. And furthermore, as a human being, I expect to be protected by the law. And when my rights have been violated and my safety has been threatened, it appears we have laws that are better enforced concerning the protection of fish and fowl and prisoners. I still live in fear, knowing that anyone can come to my door, break in, abuse and batter me, and they also may clearly walk off as nothing happened. As individuals, people fear involvement. As a collective, people merely speak of atrocities. We rarely do anything, and their attempts are thwarted by those whose hearts are atrophied. My present attorney is the third attorney I've gone through. Kathleen Heron with the Community Law Project.
That's my present attorney. Who was
your first attorney? My first attorney was Mr. Duncan, and I had to dismiss him because he committed acts, personal acts upon me, unzipping my clothes, and I will be very, very frank and blunt about it, and wanted to touch my bruises and sores, where he had pictures to refer to that, so I dismissed him. My second attorney refused to take it because he said, if this ever gets to court, the man who assailed you will kill you. He says, this man has a past. And yes, he has. I was able to talk to his former wife, and she abandoned her children with a third party so that she could leave town so that he couldn't find her and continue battering her, which he has done in the past. And because she is so afraid of him and his behavior, she's had to disappear. My attorney said that with a past like that, he will kill you. Now, my present attorney, Kathy Heron, is not willing to take it to court because she fears the jury's decision on this.
How long ago did these events that you preferred to occur?
The assault occurred on March 17, 1978. And since that very
day,
were
you acquainted with the assailant?
We were engaged up till the day before, at which time he exhibited violent behavior, upon which I invited him to leave because I will not handle it and I can't handle the violent behavior. He left, but he came back the next day and did all this to me. So, you know, I've been trying to stand up for my rights, and all I'm trying to do now is collect my losses. My wages lost for 3 months, medical fees that the insurance company wouldn't cover. I've the things that he removed from my house, the things he broke. I'm really. I have a lot of feelings about that, and I feel I have no rights. I feel I'm not protected. What now is my question. What now? What can I do? Where do I go? Who do I see? Who has anything to say? I don't want a pat on the head. I want some answers. I really do. I'm really concerned. I know I can't be the only one that's in this position. There must be hundreds and thousands of others. And like this man's ex-wife. Because she feared him, she did nothing. How many other women are there that fear their men and do nothing? I think enough of myself and of my future to do something about it. And I'm not going to stick around for a second time. I don't know.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for
and
hearing me.
If you want to turn your testimony at any point, the clerk will receive it and put it in the minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else who wishes to testify on any of the measures that are before us this morning? Okay, I think what we'll do is take a 5-minute recess. Joan, can you see if you can find us two more members? And tell them that I believe that we can move things rather quickly when we do have a call.
We need one more.
One more if we can agree, two more for safety. we need four votes to get anything out of the Okay, one more is fine. We're in recess for until 5 minutes past 10. Committee will reconvene. The first measure before us will be HCR 2, which establishes the Forgotten Victims of Crime Week for up in the third week in April. We have a set of proposed amendments, and those were supplied with an afternoon by
Representative
Starr. Very briefly, we had two witnesses testifying this. There was no testimony in opposition to it. We asked Carl Haas why this week was chosen. He informed us that 10 states are holding that week and designated as the Forgotten Victims of Crime Week, that the governor has scheduled an executive proclamation for that same week. The Oregon District Attorney will all be present en masse in the state capitol that week to talk about crime victims and all and other legislation. 4 to 5 busloads of victims, some who are able to achieve compensation, some who are not, will also be brought down that week. So if we're to do anything as a legislature, as opposed to the events that are happening in communities around the state, this is one of the issues by which to do it. There are also proposed amendments that were brought to us by Representative Starr, the sponsor of the bill, and they simply add to some additional rhetoric to the bill. HCR amendment.
Move the amendment.
Representative Rutherford moves the adoption of the amendment proposed by Representative Starr as proposed amendment HCR 2. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Not so ordered. Any motions on the bill as amended?
I'll move it forward to pass recommendation.
We haven't changed a little bit.
I would suppose Representative makes that motion that includes that it be engrossed with the recommendation that the House have it engrossed. Support bill to the House floor.
Yes, yeah, correct.
All right, discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dugas?
Aye.
Fromer?
Aye.
Fromer?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Carried. The next measure will be House Bill 2364, which you want to look at in conjunction with House Bill 2635. And I suppose both of these bills deal with the same subject legislation, which is the victim of crime compensation legislation. We had 7 witnesses favoring the measure, none opposing it. The folks from SAFE who administer it came in and suggested by and large that they had no objection to the proposal. There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on the bill because it does have an increased fiscal impact if all the recommendations are accepted of something on the order of $225,000. Is that biennial or?
That's a year.
That's a year.
Yeah, it's $450,000 biennial.
And I think they're all aware that may have some impact on what happens afterwards, but at least there seem to be concurrence on the proposal. If the subcommittee is inclined to act, it would be the chair's hope that we take 2364 as the vehicle and then insert into it the concepts of 2635 that we may agree on that are not in 2364, so that only one bill would go to the full committee and then subsequently be referred to Ways and Means. For those of you who were not present, let me try to summarize, and Joan, you add on to this if I omit them, the policy decisions that have to be made. First of all, the bill would remove the $250 limitation, which is effectively deductible before a crime victim can take advantage of the funds. Testimony both of SAFE and of the district attorney's office was that lots of elderly victims are in fact frozen out of the measure because their losses are less than this, but they have no other fund from which they can achieve compensation. That would bring by far the largest fiscal impact in the bill. If the committee wanted to play with the deductible, lower it to something less than 250 but more than zero, I suppose that's a possibility also. On the second policy decision, we have to decide whether or not we wish to eliminate the provision that the victim and the assailant not be related or be sharing the same household. The principal testimony in this came from women's rights groups, several of which testified today, including the Governor's Commission. The argument is that much abuse occurs within the household, particularly spousal abuse. The provision was copied from the Washington law, and at least has been some indication from the state of Washington, from the administrators of the funds, that they wish that provision were not there because they can't adequately deal.
Even what provision is?
Looking at 2364, it's on line 7 of page 3.
The victim and his assailant were not related to sharing.
That's right.
That is in Washington law?
That is in the Washington law. They wish it were not, or even copying the Washington law in the course of passing its own in this respect.
And who says they can't work it?
Well, the people from Washington were of the view that it works an injustice on victims of spousal abuse or roommate abuse.
That's the policy.
Yeah, that's
where
my
garage coalition is.
That's
not something about workability.
No, there apparently is not a problem with workability. It would require some increased investigative costs on the order of approximately 2 FTE, but that's probably all. The third major policy decision, 2364. Is the extension of the victim's compensation bill to cover acts of criminal negligence. District Attorney Haas testified that this is one of the situations in which they're the most poignant kinds of victims are currently excluded. The SAFE people testified that they're
was no significant fiscal impact in extending the builder's criminal negligence. The fourth policy decision was to cause us to move to 2635 and take in some of the provisions that are adopted in it. The first is an increase in the burial expense allowance to $1,500 from $1,000. Second, it would expand the group of people who could take advantage of the burial expense for the victim provision to include people who are, for example, parents of the victim rather than people who are dependents of the victim. And there's one case that was brought to our attention in that respect. And the last of the policy decisions would be limiting the time frame for appeal, which is found on page 3 of 2635, would provide some time limits for the appeal so that SAFE would know when to close the claim or whatever. There's been no particular problem with that, except in one case, but they felt that they did need some kind of finality. And this provision would essentially track Senate Bill 280 of this session, which has been introduced on the other side, that would do the same sort of thing. All right, with that in mind, why don't we...
Inquiry, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sorry,
I missed most of the testimony, but I remember the bills very well from the last session. Was there any testimony with respect or from anybody about the application of this one section on 2364, which is intended to be amended out, that the deduction of the 250 is subject to a finding by SAFE that a hardship exists? Is this, they don't have to.
No,
they don't have to have a 250 deduction if they find a hardship exists. And I would.
I don't believe this. That's not my understanding of the bill. The language that would be changed is found on lines 38 and 39 of page 2 of House Bill 2364.
Well, but my point is that now under the existing bill, the language is workman's comp shall deduct 250 unless they have a finding that extreme hardship exists.
Yes.
Down on lines 27, 28.
There was no testimony. I would assume that representatives from the state would have said that people are showing extreme hardship all the time, if in fact they were.
It may be that, philosophic or as a matter of policy, this millionaire lady who gets beat up horribly shouldn't have to show hardship, and I just wondered if there was any problem of applying this, or if they even tried to. I suspect that they would find it more easily administered if they didn't have to try to make such a finding. Maybe it had to go into home or personal affairs or something. But as I understand it, it's a total of $250,000 per annum that all of these changes would affect.
Yes.
Is that a problem?
The rough edge estimate. Yeah.
But just multiplying out the total number of victims and by 250 times 290, you get 72.5.
Mr. Jim.
Lynn Richard.
I have community leaders from the Spanish-speaking community, the Indian community, and the Black community downstairs in a committee that I'm supposed to be chairing. And I guess I would just ask the chair when we will be moving toward the position that we'll be voting it out, and whether or not my presence here is necessary as a quorum to vote from the subcommittee to the full committee these issues. I feel a real responsibility as chairperson of Aging and Minority Affairs to be present for the testimony of those witnesses downstairs.
Well, we're going to move to resolution of the policy issues right away. If you leave, Representative Richard, three members of the committee, subcommittee, can successfully move something to the
full committee.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, then, out of respect for those people, I would like to go back and resume my responsibilities in Aging and Minority Affairs.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay. Why don't we just take them in order? The first issue is whether we wish to remove or lower the $250 limitation with or without the hardship. Representative
questions, Longboard?
Well, I guess I do have the same question that St. Bugis has. Is SAFE applying the standard that we gave them last time to give them some flexibility? Or have they just ignored it?
Representative Rutherford?
What I would suggest is that we do the other matters that we want to do, this bill carries to the full committee and advise them back, touch by on that question.
Well, there are two provisions here. One is a threshold that you find in the bottom of page 3. It is a threshold, and then it's only if you've met the threshold that you're then qualified to receive any compensation.
Let me say, Mr. Chairman, I raised the question, and I am concerned about cost, but I'll be frank with you. My inclination on these bills, even if it's a quarter of a million or a half million, is to vote for them to broaden and expand this policy. I think it's a good one, and I intend to vote that way. I really am curious about how it's acting and how the workman's comp people are implementing it more than anything else. I'd much rather see some of these, for instance, than the money spent for these. I feel more distinctly in favor of more money for these than I do for instance some of the other things, such as very expensive additional legal help for criminals.
Yeah, Representative Longworth.
Question. I just been advised that one of my bills, my other bill is now on agriculture and natural resources, and I'm the principal witness on that bill. Are you able to keep your quorum?
You will have to exist in happy agreement. Yes, you're excused.
Yeah.
Okay, I think our thing.
We'll do your will.
Representative Rutherford's suggestion is a good one, and Joan, what we'll do is take the issue of the $250 to the full committee. I'd like you to ask SAFE to testify on their understanding of the interaction of those two sections. My understanding of it is that you have to have a minimum $250 loss before you're eligible for consideration at all, but I may be misconstruing.
If you need my vote, you know where I am.
The second thing I'd like you to ask them is to see if they could scale any deductibles. What would a $50 or $100 deductible do to the fiscal impact of the bill? Okay, second issue. Position on the people who are related to each other, which would be, in essence, the deletion of line 7 on page 3.
I would support deletion of
that, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rutherford moves the deletion of line.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm not moving to delete that because it's already deleted under that. What I'm saying is okay. I support the deletion.
Okay.
I don't think
since we have the bill before us, actually, we take a motion to reinsert it. Okay. Is there any disagreement? Okay. Next policy question is the extension of the bill to cover acts of criminal negligence, which is accomplished by line 12, page 2.
Yeah, Chairman, I don't even involve one NACOM's case. I found it not only tragic from the victim standpoint, but tragic from the defendant's standpoint of the case. Truly terrible situation. But I was Representative Rutherford handling the.
What are you talking about, automobile?
Yeah, drunk driving, essentially, just with your. A drunk driver ends up, killing someone, and the vicious enough, terrible aspect of it is there, but a fortune can go, you or I or lots of our contemporaries. I mean, it's the type of case that can give you nightmares. I probably will support this extension to negligence, to the negligent case, but I have a few, I'm a little uncomfortable because there just isn't the element of criminality in a NAGHOM case. It's an element of tragedy is what it is.
Of course, we're not talking here about restitution or even a civil suit. We're talking only about what the victim would receive.
That might be the proper ground upon which to support the
extension. The posture of the bill is, Representative Russell pointed out last time, is that unless there's a motion to delete it, I'm assuming that we'll have the support of the committee. OK,
I'm a little nervous about it. Let's discuss that possibility of litigation.
Okay.
These are almost inevitably, at least as I view them, and I defer to you, seems to me like they almost always rise out of an automobile situation where you got drunk and driving. And I'm not insensitive to it, but they almost always involve a legal case. I don't think you're talking about your classic crime. I hope the bill isn't jeopardized when we get to the floor by anything like this. I sure would hate that. This type of person isn't without some kind of remedy. And of course,
it's interesting that I remember last session that the thrust of this whole thing came out of that case. I ended up in Tolman County, which was a negligent homicide case. You may recall I don't recall the name of the case now, but it was an automobile accident. Party been killed.
You mean the whole victim to crime?
Well, the major portion of the thrust for it was the fact that the Supreme Court had ruled that the party could not recover.
Yeah, but I don't remember that as... Well, all I can say is that motivated me.
All I'm suggesting is that would seem to underscore the need for including the negligent homicide cases in this. Because the one major underpinnings of
is the $250,000 a year, does that include a contemplated, I don't suppose there's any way for him to really project.
But there was no, the view of SAFE, who administers this, is that the impact of adding negligence would be minimal. Which sort of surprised me that they couldn't come up with any figure that's significant.
I think that's a pure guess.
Mr. Chairman, we've been creating a situation again. Where if the victim or the victim's administrator, the victim's estate, essentially, or whoever's planning the action, were to find that there was no insurance in an automobile case, there was no insurance available, that because of that may go to a district attorney and ask that the case be presented as a nay com.
Good point. I'm not sure that that's precluded.
As a nay com in order to find a deep pocket. Maybe I'm conjecturing too much, but
you still have the grand jury.
What kind of if there is a pocket here in a non-insurance situation that we may be opening up, and I'm a plaintiff here, so maybe
we just revised the mandatory insurance bill yesterday, so that's going to be hopefully fewer and fewer cases.
And if it was a person who was deceased, the victim's the 72-hour rule probably wouldn't apply.
Okay. Well, I don't have strong feelings in the matter, one way or the other. It seems the case was made for it.
Well, it's just the
subcommittee ought to do its will. What? Has there been motions? Any motions on
no.
Language?
No. No motions.
Well, it might be appropriate for discussion in both committees.
Yeah.
Thank you, John. All right, that's all the issues that were brought to our attention on that bill, but if we proceed ahead the way I wish we would, then 2635 would bring us a couple of extra considerations. One would be the increasing amount available for burial expenses from $1,000 to $1,500.
Mr. Chairman, I move to increase the amount of burial expenses.
All right, Representative Rutherford moves to increase the amount of burial expenses
$1,000
to $1,500.
Again, that is a part of the bill.
Well, no, it's part of a different bill, which we would
yes,
choose
I,
to amend.
Oh, you want to amend
so
into this?
So it would amend the
motion now is to amend 23. Okay.
Yeah.
I follow.
Any discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chairman, I further move that amount could be paid to the relatives of the deceased person, even if not the dependent of the deceased person, where that relative pays.
Okay. You've heard the motion through discussion.
Have we spoken on to that last time?
No, we did not. We limited it to expenses incurred where the person people are dependent upon the victim, but not the reverse. And the case was brought to our attention of the child who was raped and murdered, and the parents were unable to make a claim on the funds because they did not technically fit the language of lines 23 to 25 as they were in the original bill text.
Okay.
So?
Let me just make sure I understand your motion, Bill. That is then, would be to change the language in 2635.
2634, we're going to put all those questions.
I understand that, but what I'm going to do is take the language in 2635. You said where the relative has paid or becomes obligated to pay.
Right.
So you're trying to pick up the
right.
cases that he pointed out where people can't afford to
right.
pay. Okay.
All right. Any discussion?
You may want to change that wording.
Objection? Okay, the last issue is to adopt some time limits, and really there was no specific testimony with respect to what they ought to be, except that there ought to be some so that there's some kind of finality in the determination. And suggested language is found on the third page of 2635. Any motion?
I think you're in Section 5 now, right?
That is correct. It's going to be Section 4. Section 4.
And yeah, there are two different
separate
yeah, okay.
provisions.
Do you want to handle both of them? Or one,
I,
yeah, one
I
of
think
the
so in concept. If there's any problem, we'll separate
them. I don't see.
All right. Representative Frohnmeyer, Chair, moved to adopt the proposed changes. Any discussion? Objections? Any motions on the bill as amended?
Mr. Chairman, one other amendment. I think you should address the problem pointed out with respect to reimbursement that provided funds can be paid, I think probably directly to the vendors in the cases where the vendor of the services where the party is unable to make that payment initially and then be reimbursed. Again, Joan will have to draft that, but I'm inclined to think that this money should go where there's an outstanding obligation to go to the party of
mortuary or hospital.
Or
it looks like at least 50% of this goes to the doctors.
Rather than have that written in the statute, it would be appropriate to have that in the administrative discretion for the administrators of the funds to be able to make vendor payments.
Well, I was trying to think under what circumstances you would make payment to the person who was not out of pocket that money. I can't think of it. What I'm wondering is if you won't run into a problem.
Well, the claims may exceed the value of the fund or the recovery, in which case you would have a bankruptcy problem, but you do have a priority of creditors problem. The law could stipulate that the vendor can pay directly, but that might then just mean erase the fund by the creditors.
Well, my concern is, quite frankly, I see this from time to time in practice, is the check comes to the person who is obligated to pay, but who's not paid the money, and they take the money and buy a new car, and then the person who renders the service at the hospital or whoever else without the money.
Part of the problem is that these are victim compensation bills, not hospital compensation
yes,
bills.
Yes, I understand that. It does appear that that's entirely a practical way to work.
Well, except that he did say, Mr. Barnes did say that the examples he gave were of people who weren't eligible for compensation because they hadn't actually paid anything because they didn't have the money.
Right.
So they weren't out of pocket at all.
Right. And what happens in those cases sometimes is when the party gets the money, it's more money than they had at one time. And that's just, I think the temptation is going to be great. And they cash the check and spend it. And then they still owe the money to whoever they owe the money to. And so the purpose was to compensate, but the compensation
Bill, would you mind if Joan tried to wheel it?
Yeah.
Some language and bring that to the full committee, too. I think that I like the concept of it.
Sure, exactly.
Any objection if we do it that way? Okay. Any motions on the bill as amended?
No. Bill had a motion to pay directly to the vendor in certain cases. That was accidental.
I wasn't in, but I thought we might take the policy issue. I just forgot to add it in case it's amended.
That's fine.
Okay. Any motions on the bill as amended?
You're talking about 2364.
Yes.
I agree with the full committee.
Yes. The full committee was the recommendation that we pass as amended and printed in gross. So, further discussion? Clerk will call roll.
Representative Venus?
Aye.
Remar?
Aye.
Mayor?
Aye.
Trustee?
Aye.
Okay, carries.
2635.
2635, I don't even have it. Representative Mason moves that House Bill 2635 be tabled. Clerk will call roll.
Representative Venus?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Remar?
Aye. Okay, we have the Son of Sam bills, and I believe we have two of them, Joan.
There's only one on the agenda. The other ones we either got after we set up the agenda or we forgot about it or something.
Okay. And that would be 2362. This is the Son of Sam bill that would provide for levying on the contract of, and registering the contract of anyone who, as a crime victim, sells part of his or her story, thoughts, dreams. The accused, and that would go into the compensation fund for purposes of helping to compensate individuals who were damaged. Testimony on this was from Representative Starr, who favored it, arguing that New York had passed this statute in light of the Son of Sam murder cases. Apparently, there's no litigation as to its constitutionality and the First Amendment or other kinds of issues. The folks from Safe testified that they thought matters would probably be hampered somewhat administratively by handling all these accounts and by trying to determine who had signed a contract. The contract D has to give notice of some kind. Question was raised by the chair as to whether or not the victim restitution law of 2012 that was passed last time would be sufficient to take care of this concern. The last and final concern was that in some of the versions of federal legislation dealing with compensation of crime victims and providing a federal match, that there is a provision that the states have to have such kind of language. But in the latest versions that are being worked on by Congress now, there is no such requirement. Representative Rutherford?
Well, I certainly do not think that for the perpetrator's crime classified, and I would be interested in legislation which strips them of any profit or gain that they made from it and sell it for the victims. I am interested, however, in the concerns that the chair raised, and if we could do one or two things, we would be straightforward and ask the folks may have asked those concerns to be addressed or carry the bill as you raised, whichever we're doing. Well, I appreciate your concerns. However, I'm a little worried that if we were to not have this type of statute in existence, there might be one sensational terrible case that would occur and holding it in a Sam type situation. And the remedy there might be under the restitution statute. However, the remedy is not worth. There would be no fallback position, and the passage of a bill like this in some other session would do nothing to cure that situation, because that would be an impairment of contract, and it would be a I think you might be able to make an argument that this should be on the books as perhaps the backup for the restitution. Although I think the point you make that we could have one tragedy prevented by.
Well, Senator Mason moves that the bill be sent to the full committee with the recommendation that it do pass. Discussion?
I would just say one thing, Mr. Chairman. I've noticed in reviewing the bill on line 19, and again, it's limited to a dependent who's there again. If your child was the victim of this crime, they would not have a right of recovery under this. Apparently, they would not have a right of recovery.
That's correct.
Thank you. I would move to amend to cover those cases where
victim, victim relative.
Well, I think we need to do some thinking about how far we intend to extend it, but I certainly would at least want to cover children.
At parents. Well, I think your intention is to cover those who become obligated for expenses as a result of the killing.
That's correct.
And not just rewarding people who are blood relatives.
That's right.
So it's not a general right of recovery or survivorship statute.
That's right.
Specifically related to the incurring of expenses. Okay. We'll have to make that motion in concept, but I think we understand what it's doing. Is there any objection? Not in order. Further amendments? Further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Fugit?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Westry?
Aye.
Fine, carried. Thank you all very much. We have to see each other two more times today. We have